niggas kids with their shanks. And that's the way it is. Come on, come on.
That's just the way it is.
The great Tupac Shakur shot on this day, actually yesterday. We remember him with his song, the great Baltimorean, great interesting human being. And as I always say when we talk about him, my former student at Baltimore School for the Arts, Tupac Shakur. Now we turn to our conversation with Katrina Vandenhoevel, who's editor, publisher, and part owner of The Nation magazine. Katrina, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. I want to tell you when the email went out that I was going to be on your show, I got a note from John Cavanna, who heads the Institute for Policy Studies,
right,
which I recommend everyone listening, which really does extraordinary work on economic justice, peace, human rights, and he sang your praises and said how excited he was that I was going to be on it. I said, wait a minute, you didn't read our progressive honor roll, John Nichols putting Mark Steiner as the radio show to listen to? And I said, I have had the good fortune to be on before. But thank you, John. So I'm happy to be on this morning.
Thank you.
I always value how you bring history to bear. Unknown, untold, underreported, humane history to bear on events of the day, or just to bring it to people's attention, because I think we're living at a moment where so much of our what we listen to and read and all kinds of things seems deracinated, decontextualized, and
yes,
dehistoricized. So it's important.
Thank you. Thank you for all of that. I appreciate it. You've been writing a lot lately. I think there's some things I really want to kind of try to go over with you, because there's some interesting perspectives here that you've written about. And I want to start with this whole question of voting.
Yes.
That you've been writing about. And it takes me back to early conversations I had in the early 90s when Lonnie Guinier was pushed aside by President Clinton, and she started talking about cumulative voting and multi-member super districts, and people lashed out at her as a racist black woman who only wanted to take care of black people. But and I remember that time very well. But there's something bubbling up similar at this moment, and you've been writing about it.
Well, I would recommend anyone listening should check out Fair Vote. Fair Vote is
yes,
a group that has been committed to democratizing our voting systems. And, we should be focused on voting rights and the attack and assault on voting rights that we're witnessing in states across this country. But redistricting is also a way which is kind of the incumbent protection racket, right? The way districts are carved up across this country. And Fair Vote has a very important plan, which is true that it links in many ways to Lonnie Guinier, who thinks very hard about the roots of democracy. But I recommend people go to Fair Vote to check out how they see multi-district, multi-districting, in a sense, broadening districts that would open up the system to a range of views. And at a moment when too many pundits lament the deep polarization of our country, what we're really witnessing is kind of the downsized, the downsizing of political alternatives and the downsizing of alternative voices, which this system, which Fair Vote has championed for years, would lift up.
I thought what you wrote was important. I was reading the New York Times this Sunday, and there was another article in there about why Democrats can't win in this country. And it was a very kind of convoluted, not very clear article, at least from my perspective. And then I was reading the stuff you were writing and what the folks from Fair Vote have been saying that have been on this program several times, many times. And I think that it's really important here, because one of the things that for all their frailties and failings, the founding fathers of this nation, the thing they talked about in the Constitution was the House representing the people of this nation.
That's
as
right.
The Fair Vote video
absolutely
was talking about. So,
we need the column I wrote for the Post was it began in the original conception of our Constitution. The House of Representatives was to be the branch of government that best reflected the will of the people. And as you know, as we near 2014, Mark, that reality of what the House was conceived of clashes with the reality of what we're witnessing. So people may know, but in House races in 2012, the Democrats won the national popular vote by more than 1.1 million votes, but they did not win the House. And by the numbers Fair Vote has done, it would shockingly take Democrats as much as 55% of the popular vote this November to secure a majority. So it's a real disconnect. It's a disconnect between the democracy we proudly proclaim we are. It's a disconnect between voters and those who are kind of installed almost for lifetime. And then we do look, as I was saying, at redistricting and gerrymandering. But it's districting in many ways, not redistricting, that is the real problem. So there's just, you know, this fair representation plan that Congress has the full authority to establish could really open up the system. And I just, you know, ask people to check out Fair Vote site. They have my piece posted there. But it would also be a way to have women better represented, Mark, in House elections.
Right.
More than 4 in 5 seats in the House still held by men. And women win, according to Fair Vote's statistics, about 10% more seats in multi-seat state legislative city council elections. So, you know, I'm sure you feel this. I'm sure many of your listeners do. We live at a moment where our imagination, our political imagination, is often tamped down because we're dealing with the reality. And we takes as much strength as we have in our bones to combat the cynicism we feel. So to really take a bold leap and think anew in innovative, creative ways about what could be is something I hope, you know, we do at The Nation. You have guests on talking about it. And I credit Fair Vote, because this isn't going to happen tomorrow, nor is the national popular vote, which would enable every vote in this country to matter as opposed to the Electoral College dominating the presidential. But they lay out and map out true pro-democracy reforms. And the good news is, you know, they get all kinds of sort of transpartisan support, because last I checked, democracy reform wasn't a left or right issue, unless you tell me otherwise. I mean, we, you know, anything can be put in boxes, but it should be something that, you know, all people who care about what, you know, this country was conceived in sin in different ways, and we've advanced, and we have ways to go, but we should keep struggling, and I think pro-democracy reform should be on the agenda of everyone.
Well, I mean, that's juxtaposed to the other piece about Mitch McConnell. We were going to play we were going to play some of that, but it was so inaudible, we really couldn't get it on the air for people to see, to hear.
That's too bad. I mean, well, yeah, we The Nation, obtained audio tape of Mitch McConnell and a few others. Marco Rubio, we have his speech at this billionaires gathering convened by the Koch brothers. By the way, the Koch brothers, you know, have become a stand-in. I mean, they are the symbol. But there are others, as we, you know, well know. I mean, in North Carolina, the politics of that good state, I hope, will be shaped in the long run by Moral Mondays, Reverend Barbara, not by Art Pope, who's the regional state Koch brother, who's kind of deformed the politics of a good state. But Mitch McConnell kind of kvetches about how, you know, the Congress, the Senate, just keeps voting on these dastardly, useless things like minimum wage, student debt, when what it should be doing is rolling back all limits on giving money. He's been the architect of that, which is why I think the race in Kentucky, tough race, has become a national one, because Mitch McConnell is the poster boy, of unshackling the legitimate and appropriate limits on money and politics, that if we don't rein in a democratic way, no one's talking about banning, but small donations, allowing people who understand the rules of this country are rigged, but giving them a voice. He got a special little privilege when they the court heard arguments in the last important McCutcheon case, which was, you know, in the sort of troika or quadrangle of campaign finance reforms, bringing him down. But he was able to have his own, he had his own lawyer, was able to give testimony. And I think he's just, you know, really fused with this issue. Anyway, I think what we need to do is remind people, if we can, about how rigged the rules are. And when we release an audio tape like that about Mitch McConnell at the Koch brothers billionaires gathering, it's not just to say gotcha, though we do think it is kind of Mitch's 47% moment, but it's about exposing the kind of bones of a rigged system that need to be de-rigged so that people have a fair fighting chance and a level playing field.
Now, folks, we are live this Monday morning. I forgot to tell you, please join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, and, of course, log on our Facebook pages, 410-319-8888. Just give folks a perspective. This is the quote that was from your article about what Senator Mitch McConnell said. He said, "We're not going to be debating all these gosh darn proposals That's all we do in the Senate is vote on things like raising the minimum wage, extending unemployment, the student loan package. The other day, that's just going to make things worse. And goes on to say we're going to go after them on health care, on financial services, on the Environmental Protection Agency, across the board, talk about if he becomes the president of the Senate. I mean, the Speaker of the Senate.
Yeah. You know, I mean, what it shows is how distorted the agenda is. I mean, they're doubling down on crony capitalism. They're doubling down on ensuring that, you know, the issues that do have mainstream support in this country won't get a hearing, won't get moving, won't get traction. And to me, what's so critical is how the big, big money dominates our politics, corrupts our politicians. It is the case, this again is a transpartisan problem, but, you know, there are scores of Democrats who are ready to pass a clean money, small donation campaign finance reform bill. In fact, there is John Nichols, our good Washington national correspondent, has a post going up at thenation.com any moment about a piece of legislation being introduced this week to tackle the odious Citizens United decision, which just kind of allowed bigger money to metastasize through our system. But just think about the kind of country. I had a chance to hear Elizabeth Warren's in conversation with Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist, last Thursday. And she speaks so clearly. She laid out her plan on student debt to give kids, students in this country, a chance. And she said, you know, it's essentially billionaires versus students. What kind of country do we want to be? Do we want to be a country that privileges those who are already so privileged, or those who are, you know, working hard, trying to build a future for themselves? Mitch McConnell is the senator for millionaires and billionaires. And I think, you know, there are millionaires and billionaires who want to support some of the agenda that he is opposed to. But for the most part, the ones he's supporting want to kind of take this country back to before the civilizing advances, driven largely by social movements, but also by allies inside a political system that so desperately needs cleaning up.
You also been writing about, and I think we had a rip-roaring debate on Ukraine here on this program last week.
I'm sure you did. It's not a subject that leads to, neutrality. Well, by the way, it should lead to neutrality. I'll tell you, I have a column in the Post tomorrow. You know, I hope the ceasefire holds. You know, 2,600 people have been killed in what is essentially a civil war in a country that is deeply divided by history, by ethnicity, by language. They're ordinary people whose lives have been ravaged. Put aside the Kiev anti-terrorist operation, the pro-Russian rebels, insurgents. But, you know, the parameters of a settlement have been pretty clear for months. And part of that is that Ukraine be non-aligned, that it not be part of NATO, that it be between West and East. It's going to need both the West and Russia, Mark. I mean, it's just part of the history of that country. But it needs its autonomy or decentralization. And how that's worked out requires political will. But the more the military engagement goes on, let me just say, we're dealing with so many crises around the globe.
Right.
I think one thing one could say astutely, I really believe this, and I don't mean to be glib, is that none of these crises are going to be solved by military means. The solution in all of them, primarily political and regional, not military and certainly not unilateral. I'm saddened because I've been studying Russia, the former Soviet Union, for 30-plus years. My husband, Stephen Cohen, and I went when it was, you know, we got to know Gorbachev, we know him, and he was someone who believed in non-military solutions, political solutions to problems. He opened the door toward a democracy in Russia, which has been shut. I'd argue Yeltsin, the impoverishment of the country, the selling off of the country to the oligarchs,
yep,
directly led to Putin and the rise of Putinism. Putin's first act in office after he was appointed by Yeltsin was to give Yeltsin and his family immunity. And I think, you know, we've seen the de-democratization of Russia. Putin is an autocratic leader, but the more Cold War we have, the more difficult it will be for the forces fighting for a different kind of Russia inside Russia. Cold War is not good for women, children, or other living beings, and the military budgets of all these countries are now going to climb. And I think, you know, you read a story in the New York, in the Washington Post today, I think I read it, where counties around this country are having problem with drinkable water.
Exactly, yes, right. All across America.
So all across America. And you're wondering, okay, we're now going to have a massive reinvestment in military budgets. The NATO powers are demanding that members of NATO adhere to the 2% GDP mandate. You're going to see ISIS and the crisis there be militarized. It's a crisis, but over-militarized so the budgets will soar. We have extraordinary needs not only in this country, but if we had a different kind of foreign policy, it would be looking more closely at a global job plan and not at military solutions to so many problems which will defy military solutions.
Yeah, I think that the coverage, especially on the Ukraine, has been completely slanted. And I think because anytime you criticize American Western policy when it comes to Ukraine or look at it with a critical eye and try to analyze it, look at the history, then people all of a sudden begin to accuse everybody of being pro-Russian, as opposed to thinking through what we're seeing here historically, why it's happening, and the role that could be played that almost happened until the kind of right-wing thugs took over in Ukraine. There was almost an agreement to push Ukraine ahead, but it's almost as if you're not allowed to speak that.
You know, The Nation, one of its finest hours in my mind was during the McCarthy period in the 40s, 50s. It wasn't Joe McCarthy, it was McCarthyism. And McCarthyism was about, in my mind, deforming and narrowing the political views that were possible to speak of without being harassed, intimidated, called pro this or that. Listen, there's no question that Russia has itself contributed to the tensions in the region, but that the West has not been pointed to as triggering the crisis we see unfolding, insisting on exclusive economic agreements, this and that, has led to some of the ugliest discourse I've seen. Not that I was alive in the McCarthy period, but I've read through the pages of The Nation. I studied it in university. And I think it's destructive. It's interesting that Stephen Cohen, my husband, who started writing here under Victor Novasky, former publisher and editor, historian, longtime scholar, has been attacked by many. But his views were very carefully echoed by John Mearsheimer,
right,
in the Establishment Foreign Affairs article just a few weeks ago. And Mearsheimer wrote, Russian leaders have told their Russian counterparts on many occasions that they consider NATO expansion into Georgia and Ukraine unacceptable. And I think the NATO expansion piece, which George Kennan, no radical, master diplomat, father of containment, warned some 16 years ago, NATO's expansion was perhaps the most fateful, tragic mistake of the post-Cold War era. This is history, Mark. This is what, when we began talking, I praised your show because the need for some sense of history is critical in terms of understanding crises, just like the ISIS crisis. I mean, we can't understand that without understanding the disastrous invasion of Iraq in 2003, what the foreign policy has been like in the region in these last years.
Absolutely, right.
I was struck again just because I do try to read the newspapers. I'm old-fashioned. I pick up a hard copy in the morning, then I move on to other. But, you know, you have a story on one side in the Washington Post about ISIS and how the president is likely to come forward with, you know, I guess it's going to be more of a military expansion. And on the left side of the paper, you have a small arms control monitoring group, which has monitored that some of the weapons we sent to the moderate, so-called moderate Syrian opposition, have fallen into the hands of ISIS. This reminds me of, you know, Afghanistan in the late 70s, where we armed the Mujahideen, and then we see the triggering and the backlash and what's called blowback. And on the eve of 9/11, I think it would be wise, one thing, you know, we should have learned is that, you know, it's exceptionalist rhetoric notwithstanding, America, the limits of American power should be very clear to people, and there should be a humility as opposed to a swagger. I think the president at his best gets that, though the war caucus inside Washington is so ferocious that it seems to have been moving him. And there's an institutionalization, which I know you've talked about on your show, of the kind of war state our country has been in, the perpetual long war, where we're droning, patrolling, policing too many countries. And the drag on what we began talking about a while back, the drag on a democracy, becomes ever more vivid as that long war continues.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor-publisher, part owner of The Nation magazine, thank you so much once again for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have you on the air with us.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
And check out this issue of The Nation. Really, the fight for racial justice is a very powerful issue. Thank you so much, Katrina.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. We'll take a brief break and come back with Dave Zirin and others here to talk about Milton Kent, to look at the latest Ray Rice video, gender and other issues in the NFL. Stay with us. Don't go away.